Game two will be tonight in New York. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for Tuesday, October 15th. Cloudy, windy, and cool. Scattered rain showers off and on throughout the day. A high of 52, winds 10 to 20 miles per hour. Tonight, sunset will be 6:08. Clear and cold, widespread frost. Overnight low 31. And then tomorrow, Wednesday, sunny and cool with some morning frost. Tomorrow's high only 56. Normal high this time of year is 62. We have some light drizzle in the area. Wind northwest at 10. 43 in Kenosha. 42 in Racine. 39 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. Coming up on 11 minutes after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have two newly recorded interviews for you. The first looks back at some instances of inspiring presidential leadership in our country's history. The second is a conversation with the author of a beautiful new children's book called Gracie Under the Waves, with a lovely environmental theme. Here's part one. As Americans are in the midst of yet another presidential election campaign and weighing for whom to cast their votes to be our next chief executive, a very, very timely book is before the public that I would urge you to explore, as I have. It is called Meeting the Moment: Inspiring Presidential Leadership That Transformed America. It is a book that looks back on six different U.S. presidents from our history, all who loom large in our historical remembrance and who played a very crucial role in the survival as well as the moving forward of our nation. And they will all be familiar names to you: Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, Roosevelt, Reagan. But the way in which they are discussed is through a very, very intriguing lens, with each of them embodying a particular quality essential to great, strong, effective leadership. The author of this book is William Haldeman, who is Vice Chancellor and Chief Strategy Officer at the University of Pittsburgh, and he has some background having served on the White House Domestic Policy Council and also has served on the staff of two different U.S. Secretaries of State, and has been a senior staff member to a state governor. So William Haldeman has seen great and maybe once in a while not so great leadership up close and knows something about this really intriguing topic, and hence the very compelling book that he has written on the topic, which is published by SUNY Press, again titled Meeting the Moment: Inspiring Presidential Leadership That Transformed America. And William Haldeman, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. It's great to be with you today.
Tell me how you came up with the idea of talking about leadership and looking at it in this particular way.
So obviously, this for me goes back a number of years. This was graduate study in the American presidency, but it's something, a passion of mine that goes back to where I grew up in the shadows of Valley Forge and Washington's Crossing and Independence Hall. I've been fascinated with the American presidency and how they make decisions for as long as I can remember. So with that that background and having the opportunity to work in the White House and work at this at the State Department, to have that executive branch experience, it's been a tremendous experience and just rewarding in that sense. So it's something I've always wanted to do. I did my PhD in American history, and to move in this direction and to think about these things that I've been thinking about my whole life and really since a child in that sense, and growing up, this is something that's really passionate to me. But I've been really fascinated with how some presidents answered the bell and how some didn't, and what qualities did they exhibit in those moments? Are there through lines with that? Was there courage? Was it judgment? Was it ingenuity? And a lot of the qualities that you mentioned in your opening. But I found that there's six of the greatest presidents exhibited a distinct quality to meet their moment and transform America. And it wasn't a quality that just popped into their leadership moment at that time. It was something that they cultivated over the course of their lifetime. And you can see that strand through. So when they were in that moment of crisis, that situation, whatever that was to that, unique to that president, they were able to leverage that and meet their moment. And then there's the other examples where there are presidents that have not done that. And to me, I wanted to tease that out, not only for myself, as I was interested in that, as you think about your own life, everyone has their own leadership moment in their own life. So whether it's in your family, in your career, is it in the classroom? Is it in a corporate boardroom? Is it in the face of crisis? Is it a stand you make in your community? Everybody has that moment in their own lives that they're going to meet. And what was it about these presidents and what quality was elevated in their moment that we can learn from? And that's the genesis of this book.
Did it was it a case of you coming up with these six different qualities, judgment, ingenuity, dedication, courage, confidence, optimism, and then selecting presidents who best embodied those? Or did you look at these six particularly effective presidents and then think about the qualities that most explained their importance? Or is it sort of a false framework to separate one from the other?
So definitely started with the idea in mind that there's from historical polls from the Wall Street Journal to C-SPAN polling that generally there's a list of 10 to 15 presidents that are consistently ranked among the best by historians traditionally. And I wanted to look at some of the best that in the eyes of history. And what was it what was the quality in each of them that you could tease out that made them great? And interestingly, as I found that it was a distinct quality for each of those. But that's not to say that leadership in that sense, what I found is there's really no set formula for leadership, that there are many qualities that comprise it. It really depends on the leader and the circumstances. So for example, like dedication and ingenuity work on some occasions, whereas confidence and courage work on others. I think, in my view, judgment is something that all leaders need across the board. That's fundamental. But you also see how some presidents exhibit optimism, and that can change the world. So I think it's unique that there was a one specific quality that could be pulled out for each of these. But that's not to say that if I was to say that to you that George Washington, for instance, I used judgment as his defining characteristic. He exhibited courage. He exhibited ingenuity, and a number of examples of the characteristics in this book. So there's just one that I feel was exemplified from them, from each of these individuals, that ultimately helped to transform America. So I would say, just to answer your question again, it's just started with the president and then was able to tease out a quality beyond that.
Right. And, of course, these six qualities in many cases are not perfectly distinct from one another. That is, often in many cases, there is one that really requires one or two of the others and in tandem. and often they are seen in tandem. But I do think the way you have put this together really works wonderfully. Before we talk about a couple of these specific qualities and presidents, I want to circle back to your biography. I shared at the top that you served on the White House Domestic Policy Council at one point, and we don't necessarily need to know specifics about exactly when that was or for what president, but I would just be curious to know if your proximity to the White House, and for that matter, in your service to two different U.S. Secretaries of State, how much that directly correlated to this interest in leadership. And I guess maybe what I'm really asking is, did you learn anything significant in that real life work in terms of what great leadership really looks like?
Greg, I think it's invaluable to have this experience. I think that there's, from a historical perspective, you see some historians such as Doris Kearns Goodwin or Arthur Schlesinger Jr., who have married their academic credentials with government experience. I think it's invaluable to have those. I think that this is what this book is attempting to do in that sense, is to pull some of those lessons out. I think anytime you're that close to how decision-making is done and the nexus of power around that, you get a good sense of how the White House works, or how does our foreign policy establishment work. And a lot of that stays the same over the course of different administrations. Obviously, you have different leaders, and depending on what political party they are. But I've found, just even working with civil service folks, that there's a flow of the federal government, depending on that constantly flows through. But there's obviously change at the top in terms of overall policy. But for me personally, having the experience, I've always studied decision making throughout my graduate school and into my PhD program. My dissertation was on presidential decision making. So for me to have a sense of looking through that lens, that was certainly the lens that I was looking at in many respects when I was in government and seeing this across federal government, state government. But how do these leaders make decisions? And what are the things, how do they pull people together? What is their process to make a final decision? There's obviously different processes in the federal government around deputies committees and principal committees that meet to work on a decision-making matrix in order to present a decision to the president. To me, that's fascinating. I love that. I love thinking about that. And that lens certainly it definitely colors the focus of this particular book. Obviously, some of the decision making lenses go back, like George Washington or the decision around Thomas Jefferson's decision making. Certainly, we're looking centuries old. But when you think about decisions that Ronald Reagan made around his speech, his Berlin Wall speech in particular, there's the National Security Council and the ways of how the interagency process works. I think it's invaluable to have walked in those hallways to understand and have a sense of those things. It helps in terms of understanding what you're writing about, but also understanding the memos and the conversations with people, the oral histories around this, so you can ask certain questions and get a different perspective. So for me, Greg, I think that was invaluable to have that experience. And it's something as I think about writing over the course of my next book or such, I think it's good to ingrain that perspective into the work.
We're speaking with William Haldeman about his new book, Meeting the Moment, Inspiring Presidential Leadership That Transformed America. It examines the legacy of six different U.S. presidents, and I don't think we've yet said it, but you talk somewhat comprehensively about each of these presidents, but you really bear down on one particular moment, crucial moment, in each of their presidencies. And in the case of George Washington, he is remembered and revered, of course, for many accomplishments throughout his life and throughout his presidency. Of course, the fact that he was our first president meant that he was watched with a very particular sort of scrutiny. You say at one point, every critical judgment that Washington made and every step of consequence that he undertook defined the future of America. And I'm sure to some extent, they were conscious of that even in the moment. It wasn't just in retrospect that it was clear that that everything Washington was doing as our first president was helping to lay the groundwork for what came after. Of all that you could have talked about, you talk about a particular story of George Washington that begins in 1796. Explain the moment in his presidency that you choose to focus on and why you feel this was such an exemplary example of Washington's exceptionally fine judgment.
Absolutely. To me, George Washington, and the anniversary of this decision was a week ago, September 19th. 228 years ago, he made the single most important decision or act of judgment in American history by a president, is that he stepped down after two terms in office. Unprecedented at the time, he was the first leader in two millenniums to give up power once in his grasp. And in doing so, his message was very clear. No one had the right to the American presidency, that it belonged to the American people. It was a decision that can be, for me, very easily overlooked. Some people don't even recognize September 19th. It's not a holiday. It's not a date mentioned in most history books. But taken in context with the place, the time, to me, it's a defining moment in American history with its deep significance today as you think about Joe Biden's decision to step down after a term, as it was on the contemporaries of his time, in the sense of, it was a precedent that lasted until FDR, really almost two centuries later, and it became so ingrained into the fabric of American, our vernacular, our traditions, that the 22nd Amendment, it was created in 1951, or was established in 1951. But I think it's also important in the context as we think about today, it also set up the standard for the peaceful transfer of power that's defined America for over two centuries, and certainly came in and was tested on January 6th a few years ago. But I think in terms of that decision, it was the most important decision he could make for the nation at the time, and it turned out that it was the most important decision, I think, of any president across history. The other piece of this I will just add is that with that decision he made on September 19th, 1796, he also issued his farewell address to the nation, which was his kind of treatise on everything he learned over a four-decade career in public service. And I think that there are lessons in that are really important for us today from the aspects of the rising party spirit, the aspect of not getting too attached to foreign intrigue or foreign governments, and then the aspects of making sure that there's national unity, that was the number one thing for him in the time, was national unity. He wanted to ensure that the government of the United States, the Republic, stayed strong. And that was, and in fact, 4 years prior, he decided he was considering retirement after one term, but he didn't because he knew that he needed to stay in government and stay in power and lead to ensure that the United States stayed together. And he wanted to, when he left after two terms, wanted to ensure that we were on the right path to be to stay strong and grow as a republic.
I know we should move on to other matters, but I just can't resist the temptation to have you talk for a moment about really what I learned most maybe from this chapter, in that I knew certainly about George Washington's decision to limit himself to two terms, in a sense setting the precedent for what followed then. But I knew next to nothing about the specifics of this farewell address, which he so carefully prepared and then shared with the public, which you call one of the great amalgamations of political thought in American history. Just tell our listeners a little bit about the details of how this farewell address was put together, even how it was set down on paper and shared, because I think that speaks volumes to the immensity of this moment and the importance which Washington himself attached to it.
Yeah, I totally agree. And just to echo what you had said, to me, the Washington's farewell address is important as any early American document there is. I think to the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, this, his farewell address, and then there's Jefferson had a demarche letter to his French ambassador, I think is also important, leading to the Louisiana Purchase. But I think this particular message is really important. And I think it's important, as I say this, that Washington, this message was entirely his view, in the sense of people have speechwriters, they have ghostwriters that help them in terms of our current president to business leaders across the world. But he, in this case, had in 1792, he had James Madison, who was then the Speaker of the House. He was considered in Washington's inner circle in some capacity, even though at the time he was very partisan, and then he was taking shots at the Federalists, which in turn was taking shots at Washington. So even though Madison was picked to do this, there was certainly intrigue from Madison from a partisan standpoint against Washington's own party. But Washington asked Madison to take this lead and write this draft. It was, if I remember right, it was about 1,200 words. It wasn't overly long, but it was meant to be his farewell address that he would put out through the newspaper. Because newspaper at the time was the medium of choice for sure. Words were everything in that time period, and it was Washington wanted something in writing from Madison so that he could chew on it. He certainly made edits to it, and he worked through it. And the idea was for him to retire in September of 1792. But ultimately he decided against it. So there's aspects of Thomas Jefferson, Alexander Hamilton, all of his lieutenants across the board, John Jay, all talked him out of retiring essentially 4 years earlier than he ultimately did. And with that, he put that draft in a drawer and saved it until 1795, 1796, when he pulled it out after another 4 years of service. But that 4 years had taken a toll on him. The partisan press, the animosity, the division among the political parties, not unlike what we experience today. So the 1790s is one of the most divisive periods in American history. And there's a lot of similarities to our own time. But at that point, he said he was done. He felt like America was in a good position, that whoever was going to succeed him would he felt we were in a good place. So either a Thomas Jefferson or ultimately John Adams ended up succeeding him. But he felt like we were in a good place. But he couldn't trust Madison or Jefferson in terms of that decision. He wanted this to be private. So at that point in 1796, he called on Alexander Hamilton, his ultimate deputy, his ultimate advisor that had gone back to the Revolutionary War, and asked him to dust off Madison and Madison's draft. And he did so. But the reason he kept the draft is he never wanted someone to feel, or the American, or Jefferson or Madison to say that they were running him out, like he was senile, he was old, which would have probably been a case made in the press about Washington. It was, but not by them, because he had Madison's draft to show the 4 years prior he was going to retire. So long story short is Alexander Hamilton worked on a draft. It went from about 1,200 words to 6,000 words, but it really composed of the things that Washington wanted to get across to the nation across his four decades of service. And most of that was about this rising party spirit. He warned against divisions. He warned against, quote, the absolute power of the individual. He was promoting this aspect of unity of government. He was against this idea of foreign intrigue. He didn't like the idea that one nation could look for disinterested favors from another. This is obviously, we've seen this play out with this idea of Russian interference in our own election, 2016. But he's also was concerned about folks like Jefferson, who at times felt like maybe his support was towards France and less towards the United States. So taking shots at this, that we needed to be Americans first in the sense of who we believed in and who our allegiance was, as opposed to other nations. So this was a totality effort. This was Madison. This was Hamilton. John Jay was involved in this at some moments, but. And one of the key things I think is interesting to note, a key, like one of these historical notes, is that the Federalist Papers were written by Hamilton, Madison, and Jay. And in the case of Washington's farewell address, this was the last real collaboration between them, even though Madison didn't know technically he was collaborating with Hamilton in the end. But really just a fascinating story, and it's a great document that is read in the U.S. Senate every year as a tribute to Washington, and how that spirit of Washington's view and judgment can be seen and put to use for our own times today.
We're speaking with William Haldeman about his book, Meeting the Moment, Inspiring Presidential Leadership That Transformed America. Well, George Washington is, of course, just the first of six different U.S. presidents that are discussed at length in this remarkable book. I think what might make the most sense in our closing minutes is for you to choose one of these other five, but this is what I have in mind. What you do in each of these chapters, you've already mentioned this, is that you not only talk about this, for instance, crucial moment when George Washington made this decision about limiting himself to two terms, but in exhibiting that great judgment, then you go on to talk about what in his life took him to that moment. I mean, what about the way he was raised, what he experienced earlier in his life, led him to develop the quality that he then exhibited at this really crucial moment. I guess what I'm asking is for you to choose one of these remaining presidents, Jefferson, Lincoln, Roosevelt, Theodore, or Franklin Roosevelt, or Ronald Reagan, and talk very specifically about the life experience that particular man had, which allowed him to develop the quality which he then so memorably exhibited in his presidency. Does that question make sense?
Absolutely. So I'll jump in and we'll do Abraham Lincoln, for instance. I think in the end, his defining quality was dedication. And I think it's the dedication to the Union you see in guiding us through the Civil War. But ultimately, the dedication that he exhibited and the tone and the tenor of his Gettysburg Address exemplifies that aspect of dedication. But for Lincoln himself, this dedication can be seen across his entire life. You see this through his volunteer service in the Black Hawk War. To finding his purpose in life, where he ended up, it became public service was his nature. It can be seen in his dedication to improving the lives of his constituents, and beyond when he was often in office. You could see it when, in his first inaugural address, for example, he talked about the better angels of our nature and his commitment to his family and his faith. There's a great example in the time where he lived that there was a law in terms of service to your family, and a lot of folks would run off at that time. He was 17 years old. He had to offer his father another year of service. He wasn't particularly close with his father, but he could have ran away and moved on with his life. But he stayed around and did that other year and served in the farm in support of his father. It's that kind of dedication. There's a great quote about his mother, "All that I am or will be," if I paraphrase it, "I owe to her." It's this dedication to what seems to be a higher calling, and that it drove him through his life. He was a very loyal person, and I think that you see that in this aspect of Abraham Lincoln. And I'll give you another quick example is FDR. There's an element of confidence that was exhibited in FDR, which really emanated in many ways the relationship with his mother. It just really demonstrated to him, or tried to instill in him, that he could be or do anything that he wanted to be. He obviously came from a more affluent background, and he had great experiences throughout his life in terms of opportunities around education to career options. But there was an inherent confidence in him that you can see is a through line throughout his life. And in that moment, which I would tease out in terms of at one of the lowest moments in American history, it's 1933. We're in the midst of a banking crisis. Herbert Hoover was leaving office, basically throwing his hands up, thinking there was nothing left for him to do. There's an aspect of FDR's that confidence that was instilled with him as a child that went through his life, that he was able in with his smooth Hudson Valley tone across the radios of America, was able to instill that confidence in people to be able to, because people were taking their money out of the banks and hoarding their money and putting it under their mattresses, and the banking system was failing completely. It was under a complete failure. He was able to instill that confidence, like, it's going to be okay. We're on the right track. We're going to do this together. And through his confidence, he gave America confidence. And I think that those are the types of examples where you see that through line, not only in these leaders, but I think in our own lives. You see this in terms of how we meet our own moment. And I think that's one of the biggest things that I would have in terms of the takeaway in this book.
And I'm sure it is no coincidence that it comes to the public during a hotly contested presidential race. And I'm sure you want us reading this book as we think about whose name to check off on the ballot box come November 4th.
Well, I think leadership matters, right? Presidential leadership matters. And I think we've seen, as I said at the beginning, I think we've seen it where some leaders rise up and meet their moment, and some do not. And are there qualities in this book that we can see in the candidates that are on the ballot here? In many ways, we've had a first term of one of the candidates, former President Trump, that gives us an example of what leadership, what his leadership would be like in a second term. And I think that good history is written 30, 40 years after an event or a presidency. But I think that there are clues that can be left. In the like example of Joe Biden stepping down after one term, that's probably, if history's writing this, in 30, 40 years, it's probably going to be one of the most important decisions he will ever make as an elected official. And certainly how that plays out will play out over 30 years in terms of time and perspective. But I think it's important to consider this. What kind of leadership do we want from our presidents? What do we feel like they'll be up to the task when we face our toughest moments as a country? And I think that's something this book can tease out, not only for as we think about going to the ballot box in a couple weeks, or for our own lives. And I think that's important.
The book, again, is Meeting the Moment, Inspiring Presidential Leadership That Transformed America, published by SUNY Press, the author William Haldeman. Thank you, William Haldeman, for giving our country, the world, this really compelling book, and thank you for being my morning show guest. Best wishes to you.
Thank you, Greg.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two is coming up in just a moment. And the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show, I'm going to be spending time with an award-winning author by the name of Linda Sue Park, the Newbery Medal award-winning author of A Single Shard, A Long Walk to Water, The One Thing You'd Save, and her most recent book, which is titled Gracie Under the Waves, which is a book that explores the experience of a young girl named Gracie who finds herself newly alerted to the concerns of climate change and of the urgent need to preserve the beauty of the planet on which we all live. A very, very touching and beautiful story, and we will talk with its author, Linda Sue Park, about it. Linda Sue Park, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you for having me. Delighted to be here.
It's such an intriguing and beautifully crafted story. Tell us what the kernel of inspiration was. What prompted you to want to shape this story about Gracie and this adventure that she enjoys?
Well, I'm afraid it's not a very exciting answer, which is that I love snorkeling. I grew up in Illinois, so like your listeners, I grew up landlocked. I live now in Rochester, New York. New York City, of course, is near the ocean, but where I am all the way across the state in western New York is still landlocked. I did not get to snorkel until I was an adult. So unlike Gracie, I didn't learn the sport as a child, but the second I put my face in the water with my mask on and my snorkel, I was blown away. I was seeing things I had never seen in my life. And in that first 10 seconds, I thought to myself, this is it. I am going to spend the rest of my life trying to snorkel as often as I can. And sure enough, I have kept that promise to myself.
Very good. Well, that's a very interesting story, actually. And of course, it's also interesting what ends up happening to this young character of Gracie. I know you don't want to give everything away, but in a nutshell, tell our listeners about what happens to Gracie when she goes on a bit of a snorkeling adventure of her own.
Well, Gracie's path is very much like my own, in which she discovers a little bit at a time through her snorkeling that the planet's coral reefs are in terrible danger. And at first she's like, well, I want there to be good coral reefs because I want to snorkel. And then she learns that about the importance of coral reefs to our planet, that coral reefs are one of those keystone ecosystems like wetlands, like the rainforest, that are incredibly vital to the health of our whole planet. And what I say when I'm visiting schools is if the coral reefs die, the oceans will die. And if the oceans die, the whole planet will be in terrible danger, whether or not you live near the ocean, because the oceans support the life on our entire planet. So Gracie learns this, and she also learns what she, as just an ordinary girl, might be able to do to help.
Hmm. I think one of the things that you do especially well is in crafting the character of Gracie herself. We have a sense that she is, in most respects, a fairly ordinary girl, living a fairly ordinary life with an ordinary little brother that gets under her skin and so on. And yet she is someone who finds herself inspired to, in a sense, rise to the occasion and make a difference. And I think that's really, really great because someone might write a book like this and where their protagonist is sort of larger than life and a looming sort of heroic figure. And we admire her greatly, but in a sense, for a young reader, Gracie's going to feel like one of them. And I suspect that is not an accident.
Well, thank you for saying that, and you're exactly right. I think that there's several things in what you said, and one of them is that everyone is the hero of their own story. that we look at other people around us and think, oh, they might be ordinary, but everyone has abilities and stories inside them that we don't know about, and part of connection and community is learning other people's stories, because once you know someone else's stories, you see them as an individual and not as some part of an anonymous kind of group. And the other thing is that Gracie finds her way into what I think we all need to do, whether we're young people or adults, which is to figure out where what you love, where your passions meet the world's needs. Hmm. So everyone has the ability to help in some way or another, to help make our world a better place. And it is just the most effective and the most satisfying if you can do that through things that you love already. Hmm. So whatever you're passionate about, it doesn't matter what it is. Whatever you're passionate about, it doesn't have to be snorkeling. There is a way that you can use that passion to connect with other people, to create community, to help solve the world's problems, even in your tiny corner of the world, which is how it always starts. It always starts small.
I don't know to what extent you have children in your own life, I suspect, though, you, in one way or another, even if nothing else in your professional life, interact quite a lot with youngsters. And I wonder what you have gleaned from those encounters in terms of how children tend to view this matter of climate change, which, of course, is so frightening for those of us adults who take it seriously and worry very much about our planet's future and what role we can play in rectifying some of these issues. How about young people? How about children? What have you sensed from those that you have talked with in terms of this issue?
Well, I love that question. Thank you very much for asking it. I'm going to back up a little bit to one of my previous books called A Long Walk to Water, which is the story of a Sudanese boy, a refugee, who eventually gets relocated to the United States, and after his education here, returns to what is now South Sudan to install clean water wells for people who have never had clean water. And that's a family friend. His name is Salva Duke, and I wrote his story, hoping that young people would see in it that one person can make a difference thing, you know, because that's certainly what Salva did, but that is actually not how they responded, and how they responded astounded me. They would finish the book, and they would ask their adults, we want to help, what can we do to help? And readers of the book have raised literally millions of dollars, I think over $4 million so far, and are responsible for the installment of hundreds of water wells in South Sudan. Those young people, mostly here in the U.S., but all over the world, are literally saving people's lives. And I was so astonished by their response. And I was like, we have this incredible untapped resource that we're just not using enough, the power of young people, especially the power of young people to shift their adults and get their adults to care about what they care about. And so I was, like everyone, well, not like everyone, but, you know, there are a million great causes in the world, and it's wonderful that people spend their time and money and energy on all of these things, but the planet really does need to be on everyone's list, and it needs to be near the top of everyone's list, because if we don't save the planet, what's the point of anything else, right? So when I go into schools, what I say to young readers is, you know, we adults are doing the best we can, but we've messed up. You know, the planet is in terrible shape because of the choices we made in the past, some bad ones, and we're sorry, but that's what we're leaving you. And you're going to have to fix it.
Wow.
You are the ones who are going to have to fix this planet so that it can still be the beautiful planet that we know and love. And young people are incredibly idealistic and enthusiastic, and they're not yet jaded. Mm. And, you know, I have my days when I just feel it's so hopeless. You know, that we will never overcome corporate greed, you know, that kind of thing. But they don't feel that way yet, and they do feel like they can do something. So in Gracie Under the Waves, I wanted to leave them with the feeling that there are tools, that there are things that they can do, each one of them, as ordinary as Gracie, wherever they live, in landlocked Wisconsin or anywhere, where they can actually make a difference to the planet. They can do something. And that's very it's very hopeful. It's very empowering. You don't have to sit there and just be depressed about it. You can actually do something.
Absolutely, very good. I want to finish out by asking you about a couple of the other things that you are involved with in addition to creating such wonderful books as Gracie Under the Waves. One of them is that you serve on the board of something called We Need Diverse Books. Tell us about that.
That's right. That actually began as a social media hashtag back in 2014 and 2015 and has grown into a 501c3 nonprofit organization that tries to put diverse books into the hands of young readers. And we know, or we should all know by now, how important it is for young people to see themselves reflected in books. When you meet a character who seems or feels like you, there are so many messages that you get from a book, which is that, you know, the book is saying, I see you. The book is saying, you matter. You are important enough for literature. The book is saying, you are not alone. There are other people like you. Those are incredible messages for a young person to receive. And for many, many decades, there were whole swathes of marginalized communities whose children never got those messages, never got to see themselves, or only very rarely got to see themselves in books. And then people started to do incredible heroic work, and we were getting one and two books at a time. Of course, we needed hundreds and thousands of them. And so that's what We Need Diverse Books works on, many different angles. They work on helping not just children from marginalized communities see themselves, but children from the mainstream to get those same messages. Yes, people from other communities, their stories are important. They do deserve literature. You should see them and you should get to know their stories, because once you know someone else's story, you can never again treat them like they're an anonymous block or an anonymous group. You see them as an individual.
Very good.
So that's the goal. Yeah, and We Need Diverse Books is working very hard on that, and I'm very proud to be part of their organization.
Great. And very quickly, what is the Rabbit Hole Museum Project?
Oh, the Rabbit Hole Museum Project is in Kansas City. It is a wonderful trip for a family. It is a National Children's Book Museum, and it brings books to life in a very visceral way for young readers, that they can actually step inside the pages of a book. It has to be seen to be believed.
Wow, sounds
amazing.
Please
go to the website and you'll get some idea. Yeah, you'll get some idea of what they're doing there.
Very good. And in the meantime, your newest book, Gracie Under the Waves. Linda Sue Park, thank you so much. Great to speak with you. Best wishes to you.
Likewise, thank you.
Bye-bye. I'm Gregory Berg, and on Tuesday's morning show, sorry about that. I thought that would be the morning show theme. It is 8:58 here on WGTD. Tomorrow on the morning show, a very exciting program indeed. I'm going to be welcoming back into our studios Jim Schatzman, and with him will be three wonderful musicians, Mark Paffrath, Maritha Paffrath, and Zachary Scott Johnson. All three of them are collaborating with the Choral Arts Society in what promises to be a terrific concert this coming weekend called Simply Folk, a concert that is going to be taking place at First Presbyterian Church. I look forward to talking with all three of these outstanding musicians, as well as Jim Schatzman, of course, about all that is going to be part of this weekend's concert, which also includes a world premiere, a work that has been commissioned by the Choral Arts from Carthage College's Maggie Burke. That'll be tomorrow on the morning show. And on Thursday, we will preview the upcoming production of Carrie, the musical at the University of Wisconsin, Parkside. And we'll also talk about this weekend's concert by the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra. And on Friday, from the archives, L. John Wertheim in his book Strokes of Genius, which talks about the 2008 Wimbledon final won by the great Rafael Nadal, who recently announced his retirement from tennis and the end of a spectacular career. That's on Friday. Cloudy, windy, cool conditions today. Scattered rain expected throughout the day with a high today of 52 degrees. Clear and cold tonight with widespread frost as we go down to a low of 31 degrees. Sunny tomorrow with a high of 56 degrees. We will warm up to the low 60s Thursday and Friday and into the 70s over the weekend. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn.